Hello and welcome to Punching Out. Every week we're here on WAO Radio talking about the problems people have with their work. Whether it's incompetent bosses or unfair policies, hostile workplaces or dismal paychecks, or anything in between, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to share your work problems with us, email us at punchingoutwao@gmail.com and let us talk about them. Tune in and punch out. Your boss isn't listening, but we are.
Hello and welcome to Punching Out. I'm Ryan, joined today by Noah.
Hi, y'all.
And Lou.
Hey, guys.
On today's show, we're going to be discussing Noah's favorite subject, education.
I don't know where you got this idea that it's my favorite subject. I certainly have no relationship to it, personal or professional.
Heard it here first, folks. Noah completely uneducated.
That's right. I'm a red-blooded American male, which means I have to be against any kind of knowledge or education in any form.
There are people who believe that, though, which is where we're going to start off our episode today. We have a couple of different angles that we're going to be taking during today's show, but this first segment's going to be focusing on the various political hot-button debates ranging through American education at the moment, from affirmative action to the content of AP courses and the ways in which the laboratories of democracy have really set some things on fire here.
I may or may not have misheard that as the lavatories of democracy, which I actually really like as a phrase for the states we're going to be discussing here.
It's not inaccurate.
No.
Noah, as the teacher in the building, where should we start?
I didn't know there was a rule in this game where you could play. I thought I was supposed to be playing defense the entire time. Anyway, as the teacher, there we go, 1 minute, 57 seconds in. I feel most comfortable starting with the most straightforward of these, which is from last December or so, the College Board released an updated framework for its AP African American Studies course. This is a new course that they had proposed. This is something that the College Board does from time to time. They will routinely update courses. I taught an AP class a few years ago, and I was invited to take a look at the changes. There's a public comment period, all that sort of thing. And when they came out with this AP African American Studies course, Ron DeSantis, I'm so glad that he's gone 2 for 2 on Punching Out episodes. He's gotten himself a little mentioned streak going, which is always a good thing, I guess. Decided to play hardball with the College Board on this and say that he considered it, you know, I don't remember the exact statements that he and his cronies put out, but basically it was woke, it was political, it would rot the minds of good white Floridian children by telling them to be sad about the abuses that black people have suffered in America, and it might make them feel guilty about what their ancestors did. And so the College Board basically took the course to a somewhat limited woodshed in an effort to maybe get money from Florida, because the College Board is a massive monopoly at this point on any kind of higher education access or higher education wheel greasing, I guess you could say. AP, SAT, almost everything runs through them. It's, I hate to do this, but this is a real let them fight moment. I have previously said some incredibly mean things about the College Board, and Ron DeSantis is about the only person that could make me cheer them on.
Yeah. Just to pull up a comment that his administration made when this controversy was starting, I think it would have been around the middle of last year. His administration's claim was, quote, that the content of this course is inexplicably contrary to Florida law and significantly lacks educational value. Florida law, under one of his horrifically acronymed bills, something like the Stop Woke Act.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Was, as we discussed in our last episode, crafted to kind of weed out the idea that injustice has happened in American society and continues to happen in American society, to make any and all mentions of such injustice taboo in classrooms and off limits for history and any other subject, which naturally is hard to square with the existence of an African American studies curriculum. And so what happened in December is the AP, having been rejected at first by Florida,
They bowdlerized the course is what they ultimately did. Uh-huh. They're not going to call it that, but that's what they did. They removed things like this. We're quoting here from an NPR article from December 6, 2023, by Joe Hernandez. The College Board releases a new framework for its AP African American Studies course. And they mentioned specifically that the new framework excludes, for example, the Black queer experience. DeSantis had apparently specifically mentioned that as one example, though it still includes a mention of 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick's protest of police brutality because it has to do with sports, so I'm guessing it's acceptable in every state. And then also includes a reference to Black Lives Matter as an example of optional further study in the class. So, you know, doesn't really try to put forward any point of view for any of these things. Just, it's there if you want to talk about it, I guess.
I think what comes to mind for me in discussing this is the effect that, say, states like Texas have historically had on the textbook industry. Because Texas is such a populous state, because it is a state governed by, you know, right-wing lunatics, it has had an outsized role in shaping, you know, textbooks that go to all 50 states, because you're not going to publish 50 different versions of your U.S. history textbook if you are, is it Rand McNally that does those?
Oh, there's like three. There's like Pearson, there's Houghton okay. Mifflin, there's one that I think has Valcourt in the name. Those might be the same one.
But the idea being that Texas has had something of a veto over history textbooks in the United States. And there's back and forth, there's pushback, there's, you know, these sorts of flashpoints come up every few years, it feels like, when the curriculums are updated and, you know, some things meet Texas standards, some things don't, some things get left out. And now Florida, which has taken a hard right turn over the last decade or so, is trying to throw its weight around in the same way, trying to shape not just its own educational policy, but the curriculum of the country, because College Board is a national institution.
If only we had a Texan on the podcast, on the show, who could maybe elucidate a little more on these
Where
things.
Would we find one of those?
Yeah, nobody wants to talk to Texans. Point is, Ryan said everything I was thinking already, which is that this is exactly like a few years ago when Texas revised its, especially their AP US curriculum. And I remember there, it was shortly after I graduated high school and left Texas, that there was a big to-do about the fact that the curriculum was going to leave out certain big hitters or mention them just in passing, notably like Thomas Jefferson, because of his whole, you know, perhaps interesting hypocrisy about all men are created equal. Also, I have a lot of slaves, and also I, you know, sexually abuse them. Stuff like that, that was striking and perhaps shocking at the time. Now we just kind of accept that as normal. And children and education has become such a battleground for culture wars and how to further push conservative agendas, all while they claim that they're fighting communism and overly liberal ideologies.
So full disclosure, I have family who live in Florida and almost certainly voted for DeSantis. And so when I say this, I know that Northeastern leftists and liberals often get accused of, you know, talking down to Southerners or signing away entire states. But joke's on them, because I'm from the deeper South than they are. So deep it's in the Atlantic Ocean. And second of all, I'm specifically talking to this kind of person or relatives of mine and so on. And here's what I have to ask. How are you not embarrassed? Like, I get, I know that the left wing of Florida and Texas are on some level very ashamed that their state is governed by people like Greg Abbott, Ted Cruz when he's not taking vacations during storms in Cancun, by Ron DeSantis, by the kind of people that are in power in those states. But I have relatives who do prize education, who do care about knowing things and learning things, who do care about history. I know that because they won't shut the hell up about every detail of pre-revolutionary Cuba. So clearly they care about this kind of thing. I understand wanting schools to push your agenda at the exclusion of other ones. I get that. Could you not find somebody who was marginally less embarrassing than Ron DeSantis to do it? Could you not find somebody less hyper online than Chris Rufo to do that? Could you like find a person who talked like a normal human being, who smiled like he wasn't wearing a skin suit to do any of this? And that's what I don't know. That's what I get it. But if anything, it infuriates me more that you are so beholden to your ideology that you're willing to put a guy who looks like he, you know, like he's making good an escape from Area 51 as your ideological standard bearer. That is the exact kind of thing that you, and we know with these right-wingers that every accusation is projection, but that is the exact kind of thing you accuse other people of doing. And somehow it's not just acceptable, but you keep doing it more. You keep enacting these atrocities in greater number, in greater depth, and with weirder and weirder people in charge of them. At some point, I really have to ask the question that, yeah, I just have to go back to it. How are you not embarrassed? How do you not have a sense of shame about this?
To give a bit of detail to our discussions of like Texas's role in shaping textbooks, McGraw-Hill came under fire.
There we go.
A few years back, there's an article from 2014 noting how textbooks published in Texas were very vague about the causes of climate change and whether scientists agree on them, and also had a caption under a depiction of slavery referring to slaves as workers.
Yeah, I remember that one fondly. It also apparently, I think that fight was the one where like the First Amendment got cut in half compared to the Second Amendment in terms of discussion time, because Texas, turns out not everything is bigger in Texas.
So I'm struggling for a transition here because I think now is a good
you
time.
You want to go into the affirmative action?
Yeah.
Well, I have a stringy one. As the teacher on here, I am often responsible for some of the most tortured segues you've ever heard in your life. And here's another one. Lou, you mentioned Thomas Jefferson. If only there were a school named after him in an entirely different state from the two we've been talking about that has recently also been a political battleground. Ryan, what am I talking about?
Very good. Very impressive. Youth pastors are in awe.
My God, that was horrible.
I didn't even hear what the who of mine is in awe. Didn't even catch that word.
Moving on.
You're going to have to listen to the episode after all.
Yes, there's a... Is it Thomas Jefferson High School in Virginia?
It's Thomas Jefferson. Hold on. So we're going to be quoting here from... Let's quote our sources. That's good.
Pedagogical practice. It's the CNN article.
Yes. It's a CNN Politics article from February 20th. Supreme Court declines to hear challenge to Virginia high school's, in quotes, race-neutral admissions policy. And why does... Here we go. Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. Two things that famously Thomas Jefferson was super in favor of. Those two and the novel. Which he literally called satanic, if I remember correctly. He was a weird dude.
We just have some fun facts this time.
The life and times of Thomas Jefferson here. Not the point.
No.
Yeah, so Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology changed its admissions policy in 2020 in an attempt to make the school a little more, a little less socioeconomically the same, I guess would be the way to put it. You know, quoting from the CNN article, the policy sought to, quote, mitigate socioeconomic obstacles faced by students of all races to ensure disadvantaged students were admitted to the school, whose student body was historically comprised of students from affluent areas. Admissions were previously driven largely by standardized tests. Under the new plan, the school admitted a small share of the highest performing students from each middle school in the county. 100 slots were separately reserved for the highest evaluated applicants overall, regardless of where they attended middle school. So they've created this electoral college type system to ensure that, you know, every middle school gets a spot in this high school if their families choose to take it, I guess.
I can't wait for the inauguration of the Student Senate. It's going to be so great.
This policy came under fire from a group of parents in the county, Fairfax County, Virginia, who sued the school board in 2021, quoting again from the article, alleging that the new policy violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause because it sought to balance the students' bodies' racial makeup by excluding Asian Americans. Asian American students had comprised 70% of enrollment before the changes. The school told the court that while the number initially fell, it rose to 62% in 2023. Now, I'm not an expert on the demographics of Virginia, but it would seem to me that that is probably not the makeup of Fairfax County, Virginia, racially speaking.
Virginian parents need to chill. I know that Glenn Youngkin was in there and is in there. I have no idea if he's still governor.
He's still around, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunate for all of us. I know that he basically got elected on this platform of, I'm going to put education under parental control, which is great. But you do know that it was your state that required a Supreme Court case to let people of different races marry each other. Again, that happened within living memory for a lot of these people. You should be ashamed of yourselves. I realize that often my role on Punching Out is kind of the person who wants to reinvent sin, but I do think that in some political sense, we kind of have to, because to hear parents say, as the Coalition for TJ, which I you're allowed to have that surgery now. Like, it's been a thing for a while, but...
Noah once again turns everything into baseball. Well done.
But to see affluent parents... And I'm going to go ahead and hazard a guess that a decent number of these coalition's most active members are not, in fact, Asian American, but are white. Say, a new species of racial discrimination has been spreading through some of our largest public school systems. It's one school, one school, one school. Like the discrimination this court invalidated in colleges last year, it primarily targets Asian American students. And I'm glad that they mentioned that, because some of you may remember the Supreme Court did in fact strike down a lot of affirmative action policies for schools. And the I forget his name now, the absolute right-wing weirdo who has been bankrolling case after case to get this done. His name is like Leopold Leo or something like that.
Leonard Leo?
Leonard Leo. There we
Which, go. Incredible name, if only it wasn't attached to that guy.
That person. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like supervillain level name, so it fits, let's be honest.
Fair enough. Anyway, Leo got that done by using Asian Americans as the hammer. And again, we've done the setup and the reminder, let's do the payoff. If you have allowed this person, if you are allowing these other parents, like, how do you not get that you're being used as the stalking horse for rich white people to once again get what they want? Like, this model minority thing, I heard it said by people that I knew, by Asian American students at my high school, that SAT scores were normalized against them, that they were discriminated against by Harvard and Yale and so on, by people who got into Harvard and Yale and so on, by people who were legacies at Harvard and Yale and so on. So apparently this discrimination didn't seem to matter, really. But it got turned into this groundswell of need to remedy this problem. And I do think that this coalition is right to point out that them striking down this challenge or saying we're not going to hear this, how is that at all consistent with what they did in the previous case?
It comes as a big surprise that the Supreme Court refused to hear this case. Samuel Alito dissented against that refusal, and I'm not going to quote Samuel Alito on this show because we do not have the time.
He's not a friend of the show, like Gorsuch.
Quoting from the attorneys on behalf of the school here, the case simply does not provide any occasion to decide whether a public school may employ race-neutral criteria for the purpose of achieving racial balance because, as the Court of Appeals held, the admissions policy for TJ does not seek, cannot be manipulated to achieve, and did not produce racial balance of any kind. There's, you know, as noted, the Asian American students are still the majority at this school. It still, you know, is probably not reflective of the population that they seek to serve. You know, this policy, say what you will about it, doesn't seem to have been aimed at achieving racial balance because it sure didn't accomplish it.
That's, to me, what is really bizarro about 2024 is that this school is basically saying, or the spokespeople for this school are basically saying, we're segregated. We are super segregated as a defense for their policies. Wild.
It is amazing that the move you have to pull now to get John Roberts to leave you alone is, no, don't worry. We're being the exactly correct degree of racist. Like, no, we're not being super racist. We're not, like, saying the N-word racist, but we're racist enough without being embarrassing. And then John Roberts says, okay, I approve. That's fine. You can do that. It bears repeating. I need to say this again, because this is one of the most infamous decisions John Roberts has ever written. And if you have read it, it is idiotic. He took two separate cases that were before the court on busing in Louisville, Kentucky, and in Seattle. In both places, it had actually produced a lot of positive results in both of those school districts, but John Roberts being John Roberts, they needed to go, and he knew that. And the sentence that he used in this unnecessary mashup was, the man is the David Guetta of the Supreme Court. And the sentence he used to sum it up was, the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Which is the kind of thing that if it came from a person who had any scruple, or in fact a soul, would be words of wisdom. But it's John Roberts, who is somewhere between a mushroom and a lizard in terms of, like, actual sentience. And therefore, it meant nothing.
Yeah. I think the summation of all of this is that the Supreme Court's decision on affirmative action at the college level is having a trickle-down effects to the high school and lower levels, and is like we're going to be feeling its effects for decades to come. It is going to embolden parents like we're seeing in this Virginia case, and embolden, you know, the worst actors in the country to try and drive that wedge a little bit further, try and push the envelope a little bit further on what they can get away with in creating a homogenous school for their children. I think now's as good a time as any for us to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit about, you know, what teachers are dealing with the last few years and why it seems like you just can't find anybody to teach anymore. We'll be back.
You're listening to Punching Out on WAYOLP Rochester. If you'd like to continue slacking off, you can find all of our past episodes on iTunes and SoundCloud. Remember, your boss isn't listening, but we are.
Welcome back to Punching Out. I'm Ryan, joined still by Noah.
Still hi, y'all.
And Lou.
Hey, guys.
In our first segment today, we've talked about some of the political flashpoints at which education has been the center in recent months, from affirmative action and the legacy of the Supreme Court's decision on that. Was it last year that that ruling was made now?
Yes.
And obviously the ongoing crusade against things like woke and CRT and DEI from governors like Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott.
Are they just mad that those acronyms are better than the ones that they come up with?
There's a real case of acronym envy, yeah.
Yeah.
And in this segment, we're going to shift our focus a little bit. We're going to talk about crisis facing teachers, which isn't entirely unrelated from the political shifts going on in the profession, but it's definitely a separate subject with causes all its own. I have a few headlines here that'll give you a sense of the issue at hand. Headline from the New York Times opinion section: people don't want to be teachers anymore. Can you blame them? From Forbes: no more teachers, the epic crisis facing education in 2024. In the USA Today: where are all the teachers? Breaking down America's teacher shortage crisis in 5 charts. So I think from those headlines, you can get an idea of what's going on. But we're going to talk about it some more.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's in a great state, the profession, based on what you just said. So I do like the idea of there being a country song called "Where Have All the Teachers Gone?" At the rate we're going, we're going to be rarer than cowboys. The reason we started by reading off the headlines is that, frankly, all of these articles kind of cover the same ground. It's ground that we've already covered, but if anything, it's gotten starker. The path has gotten more beaten, and so have some of the teachers, over the past couple years as what peri-pandemic education is going to be looking like forever. And the answer to that is teachers are paid less, they have worse benefits, they are less respected, they are less trusted. Parents, even in liberal states, and even, I would say, even when like the cause is good. For example, witness the parent strikes. I don't think you could really call them strikes because parents aren't doing labor in schools. But the point is, parents getting New York to back off some standardized testing by refusing to have their kids take it, things like that. That's the state of the profession right now. I am in a relatively unique situation. I am non-union. I teach at a school that generally doesn't have to obey a whole lot of state curricular or testing requirements. That has been responsible for a lot of the reason that I have grown to, and longtime listeners will be very shocked to hear this, kind of enjoy my job in the last 2 years. And if anything, I always have a little bit of that guilt in the back of my head because I know what other teachers are going through. And they're not going through it because they're union members, except insofar as that drives state and local governments to crap all over them. It's because education in this country after the heyday, the honeymoon, as one of these articles described it, that we had during the pandemic, where people kind of realized, hey, we're putting teachers in classrooms where they might die. They're facing more danger than a lot of these other professions that we valorize, lionize. They are being put into classrooms where they don't have PPE, where they don't have the kind of sterilization and ventilation that is common in medical facilities. We're not giving them guns like cops and so on, so they can't shoot the virus if it enters the classroom. So they're in real trouble. And I think that gave us a few months to about, I think at the outset, a couple years of people kind of chilling for a little bit. And now it's come back and it's worse than ever. Everybody's very angry that we haven't solved all of the educational problems that are facing their children, that we haven't fixed all of the social and emotional issues that a lot of students have resulting from the pandemic, that we aren't parenting right, but we're also not supposed to parent at all. We're supposed to leave that at home. We're not innovating enough, but we're also not doing enough of the basics. It's kind of a free-for-all right now. If you have a criticism to make of teachers, life is great for you right now. Everybody is listening to you. It doesn't matter whether you're coming at it from the left or the center or the right. It doesn't matter if you're coming at it from a point of view where you're arguing in favor of lower income students or other disadvantaged populations, or if you're coming at it from the point of view of, I want every school to be, you know, a segregation academy. You can do it and there will be an audience for it. I think much, much readier and much more willing to maybe overlook any kind of mistakes or oversights you may have made than even a few years ago.
Yeah, to some extent, the pandemic has, people are just nastier than they were pre-pandemic to a large degree. People are more open about their disregard for others' well-being to some degree, because in part, I think because having concern for the well-being of others became like a politicized issue during the pandemic, where masks and vaccinations were framed as, you know, doing your part to help others, and were opposed as, you know, liberal agenda, and therefore anything that calls on you to be nice to others is, you know, liberalism, it's wokeism run amok, it is too far. And this shows up in your profession, Noah, but it also shows up in like drivers being more reckless and people just being letting their freak flag fly, so to speak.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this in relation literally to drivers yesterday when I saw a guy just blow through a stop sign. No questions asked. Like, there was no way he was ever going to stop at that stop sign. And I understand kind of the reason why he did that, because nobody else was at that stop sign. Yeah, it was a busy parking lot. Yeah, there could have been a lot of factors. But the fact is that the reason why is because nobody else was there. And so his thought process must have been, I can do this because I'm not impacting anybody else. But the result of that thought process over and over is that when there is somebody there, you are going to think of that person as an inconvenience and not as, these people also exist in the world, and therefore I should behave in a way that would benefit other people, even if there's nobody else around, just because that is a good habit to get into. And likewise, there has been a gradual creep of treating other people as inconveniences to your own life that started long before the pandemic. It started, and if you want to think of this as just the natural way of a society evolving. No, I would strongly argue that this was a deliberate policy choice that started 50, 60, 70 years ago. And you can point to the decreasing or the cutting funding for civil services, for civic classes, for so many things that were a policy choice that seemed at the time to just be a little common sensey. To now we're to the point where there's no foundation for arguing against looking at zip code and your income level for attending a school, because you could argue that that is racially motivated thinking, which we have established through incremental policy choices, court cases, that is a bad thing, that these are bad and not a civic good for everyone.
I think that's exactly right. And I would further emphasize that I think these things get worse. I know that when it comes to CHUDs, the economic anxiety argument doesn't really hold water, but I do think that when you have so many more people living on the edge of the night day after day, and it's not just people who are desperately in dire straits, but even people who are afraid that that is going to be their situation if they don't do everything exactly right, it leads us to rebel in little ways, in ways where we aren't hurting our prospects for the future. So no, you're not going to talk back to your boss, because if they fire you and you're out on the street, now you have some real trouble. But you're going to run a red light, because what's that other person going to do? They don't want to die. They're going to pull back. You're going to play chicken with them, because that's a way of asserting power, a way of asserting independence. And to bring it back to the topic of this episode, the one way where I have seen sort of the same thing, let me put it this way. I deal with the kind of students that if there were something like the Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology, their parents would be suing. That's my student population, or as it is increasingly acceptable to call them, my clientele, which is revelatory in a way. Revelatory in a way that I absolutely despise, but that's the terminology. So it's interesting because these are people who have learned to speak the language of things like emotional intelligence. They've learned to speak the language of therapy speak, of psychology, to essentially say, you're not treating my kid how I want you to treat my kid. And that is one thing that I do deal with plenty. I know that there are other teachers who wish their parents ever, you know, came to a conference or talked to them. I'm actually very lucky as far as my school goes. I don't get a lot of trouble with that, but occasionally I do. And when I do, it is from parents that are particularly noticeably doing the customer service thing. And I am aware that if it's bad for me, it's so much worse if you work at a movie theater or a restaurant or, you know, a supermarket, whatever. Any kind of customer-facing profession, your life has probably gone down the tubes in the last few years. Statistically, you probably aren't working where you were working a few years ago. And if you are, you have essentially, and if you're getting paid more, which is not always the case, you are getting paid more essentially to expiate the guilt that your management is dealing with, knowing that they are subjecting you to people who think that being in a customer service situation is a zero-sum game.
The New York Times article, it's written by Jessica Gross. It leads off with this sort of culture war as a partial explanation for why we're seeing the shortage we're having. Quoting from the article, talking about teachers getting fired after criticizing a school district's ban on students learning a Dolly Parton and Miley Cyrus song about rainbows and acceptance, or for attending drag shows on their own time away from school grounds, or for using a worksheet that went along with a YA novel about a black teenager being stopped by police. Last year, the Washington Post tallied more than 160 educators who had been fired or resigned in the prior 2 years due to, quote, culture war issues. There are reports of harassment and threats emanating from school board meetings. And I do think this has part of the explanation for why, like, teachers are leaving the profession, but the numbers are so stark because 160, it's not good, but there have to be more explanations for the gaps we're seeing between the amount of teachers that are necessary and the amount of teachers that are willing to show up.
For a second, I thought you were going to say there have to be more teachers. And I'm like,
yes, correct.
Not for long, there won't be. And that's just the people who are publicly, you know, willing to admit that that's why they were fired or resigned. We know that in every one of these states, in Utah, in Florida, in Texas, increasingly in states like Louisiana and Indiana, that's beginning to happen. We're beginning to see brain drain at the high school and college levels because these are states that are putting it in as a matter of policy that anybody with a college degree is automatically suspicious unless they're lawyers. For some reason, they're exempt. But otherwise, getting more than a high school education is automatically makes you, you know, a little bit the devil. So when that's the climate that you encourage through policy, you're going to lose the people that have that. They're going to go to other states. And that has the wonderful effect of then making educated labor very easy to come by in those states, which means that conditions in those states get worse for anybody doing that because the supply has just increased. That may have affected other kinds of jobs requiring the same kind of advanced training and degrees, but there's still a teacher shortage. You know, I don't think anybody thinks of Connecticut as a particularly conservative state, but apparently, looking here at one of the charts in one of the USA Today articles, there's apparently over 1,000 teacher vacancies there. It's by far the most in what we would consider kind of the traditional Northeast. So it's not limited to the red states by any means.
Yeah, I think that's a point worth making here. Further down in that article, there's a chart that ranks each state based on its teacher to student ratio, at least in public schools. And it's tempting to want to see like a divide that mirrors the electoral map or even like a divide that mirrors socioeconomic factors, but it's hard to see that pattern on this map. New York and New England make up a lot of the top 10, but once you get past that, there's kind of a mishmash. Missouri is 12th. Mississippi, not a state you would think of as being near the top of many rankings, is 14th, you know, top half. Meanwhile, California and Nevada and Utah sit next to each other both geographically and at the bottom of these rankings. Arizona ranks 50th.
You know what I bet it is? It's that all of these, there's probably not a lot of difference between policies in any of the states, as you point out. Like it is a mismatch, but there are a lot of people moving from New York and New England to Texas, California, Nevada, Utah, and these places. And they just can't hire teachers
to keep up.
And so, yeah, there are some states that are leading the way in terms of making things absolutely worse for teachers. But even in places that don't have those kind of policies, the fact that Florida makes national news for its policies can impact the teacher hiring in another state. Because everybody sees the writing on the wall and says, it's not too long until this happens here.
Yeah, very true. And in fact, speaking of states that have made national news, if I remember correctly, Arizona got rid of its teacher of certification requirements for teachers all the way back in about 2017. And still ranks dead last. So clearly they're not using that to hire anybody away. They're not making the job any more attractive. I know that. Arizona was one of the centers of the Red for Ed movement a few years ago because teachers are very poorly paid there. And I think this kind of gets at, so we can talk about the culture war. We can talk about the respect. We can talk about the trust. all we want, and that I'm not going to tell you that that isn't a big part of it. I think, and I forget which of the articles mentioned this, but if you go into teaching, you're not going into teaching to make money. If you are, you're an idiot. Let's put it that way, okay? Or you're expecting to work your 5 years, do your nickel, as so many of these people seem to think it is, and then go be a consultant. Go make your money writing books, presenting, while never being in a classroom again unless you absolutely have to be. But the real problem is that teaching is not a good job. You can enjoy it. You can find it very fulfilling and rewarding. I often do. But it is a crap job. It used to be a much better job because for each kind of downside of it, the lower pay, the fact that you have to do, you know, you have to do continuing education like very few people do, as if you work in the public system for sure. The fact that you're constantly getting, you know, yelled at by some flavor of child and then also some flavor of parent. The fact that you're put under a microscope, all of that was matched with something. Better benefits, early retirement, the rewarding nature of the job itself, the hours were used to be pretty good. They're getting worse every year. And the fact that you were kind of expected, like you knew what you were supposed to do. You walked into the building and you taught. And now we're seeing each of those benefits has been eroded. My pay has been cut. My benefits are gone. In fact, I'm pretty sure within a week, my retirement is going to be gone too. That may well happen. We're asked to do more and more every year. And the only way we're exempt from it is if we're already taking on too much. And as we already said, in terms of the service part of things, it's gotten much worse. So you put all of that together and there's literally no reason to tell somebody to become a teacher. I've had a few kids who are, who want to become academics in the humanities, a job that doesn't exist anymore. A job that I didn't take because even when I was coming out of college, it seemed pretty clear that it wasn't going to happen, that there was no path forward in doing that. So I decided I'm going to stick with being a teacher. There seems to be more stability that way. And I was correct to make that choice. But some of my students would rather take the risk of maybe one day being a tenure-track professor or something like that than trying to stick it out in a high school classroom. And I can't really blame them.
I think there may also be something to the point that as the margins have grown thinner for a lot of Americans, you know, rent is going up, housing costs have gone up, costs of education have gone up. Having a rewarding job is nice, but there are so many incentives to take a job that just pays better. Like, rewards aren't going to pay your rent. Emotional satisfaction is not going to keep the lights on. People have to make colder, more calculated decisions starting from younger ages in order to feel some measure of economic security, some measure of this is something that I can do for the next 40 years and maybe be able to eke out a retirement at the end of it.
You mentioned rent and stuff, and that doesn't include student loans and the fact that public service used to be a way out of student loans after 10 years, but everybody can see how the program has been completely bungled for so many people. I think in the first year that people qualified for,
97% were denied.
It's some insane number because of factors that students couldn't control. This was entirely on either the government or the private companies running these loans.
And you do not have to hand it to the Biden administration at any point, but this was a priority for them. And you know that it was because they put Franklin Cordray in charge of the Office of Student Aid. And that dude is like, the rare example of a good, he's what Pete Buttigieg thinks he is. And he actually made PSLF work. I am a PSLF forgiveness. I am a PSLF success story.
When you say PSLF,
public service loan forgiveness. You would pay on income-based repayment, or there are several other plans you can use. Pay what you can for about 10 years. The rest is forgiven. And this is without reference to other programs that also enable student loan forgiveness on a shorter time frame. And let me be clear. This was not an Obama accomplishment. That was a George W. Bush era law, although it was under a Democratic Congress. And the first people became eligible for it in 2017. Betsy DeVos wasn't going to pass up all of that student loan money. So, of course, the program was completely bungled. And even under the Biden administration, it was real tough sledding to keep up with my loan servicer, who is Mohela, who has their own set of Panama Papers now out there on the internet, which is great. You love seeing that. But they actually made that a priority to make it work. They actually did do that. And every time you see one of those NPR articles where Biden takes credit for a government program working for a change, you do get to hear from people who worked there 10 years to, you know, finally get out from under that. I have only been at my job by choice since March of last year. Before that, I was stuck. I am now employed there because on some level, I want to be. That makes a huge difference.
Yeah. We have 5-ish minutes left. I don't know if we have any thoughts on how we want to wrap this show up, but I figured I'd leave that to you, Noah, as the teacher in the room.
Can I throw out what my Seg 3 salutation was going to be then, since we're essentially doing that now?
Okay, why not?
School.
Thank you.
Classic.
Anyway, in all seriousness, oftentimes when we are finishing up the show, it feels kind of bleak because the answer is out of our reach, or it's too complex, or there are lots of things that the three of us maybe don't get about it, that it requires expertise we don't have. That is not the case here. We know what the solutions are. The solutions are you pay teachers better, you fund their schools better, you fix their schools, which is not that complicated. There are schools near me where literally what they need is a new roof. That might be expensive, and it might be a lot of work, but it is not a difficult decision to make in terms of, does a new roof help a school function? There are a lot of schools all over the country that need new roofs, that need capital updates done, physical plant updates, okay? You fund those schools, you pay the teachers, you trust them. And I know this is the hardest part because it's the least concrete. You get parents to like maybe figure out that if they're going to be working full-time and putting their children in school for hours and hours and hours a day, maybe they don't get to dictate everything that happens there. They are partners in what we do, but they are not going to get to control that because, frankly, I went to school for 8 damn years to learn what I do. And that's not including all the stuff that I've learned about education. That's just the content. I don't go and tell my doctor how to evaluate my blood tests. I don't tell my dentist which teeth to take out. I don't tell my accountant how to do my taxes. But for some reason, when it comes to a service job, everybody is willing to say, no, I can do it better than you. So solutions are simple. They are not complex. We know what they are. This isn't a massive web of intersectional challenges. You want to get teachers back in the classroom. We know what we have to do. The problem is having the political will to do it. And that is where we circle back onto the Ron DeSantis and Samuels Alito of the nation, who are going to do everything in their power to continue vilifying teachers and demonizing them and turning education itself into a mark, not just of elitism, but liberalism, by associating knowledge with that. And again, I keep having to come back to this question. We already went through waves of this. For some of the people engaging in this, like, they've already seen how this ends multiple times over when we surrender to the people who talk about eggheads, who talk about intellectuals, who often get into some real weird tropes about certain subsets of the population. when we surrender to them, the country does really stupid things, like, you know, get into the Vietnam War and send 58,000 Americans off to die for no reason. Or we cut tax rates down to two idiotic brackets and forever usher in an era of deficits and overspending by the government because we can't expect the rich to pay their fair share. Or we, like, drop the biggest bomb ever made by the United States military on some random cave in Afghanistan. That's what happens when you listen to those people. You look stupid. No one respects you. No one in the entire world.
I want to thank you, Noah, for tying together these two segments of today's show with that last bit there, because I think, like, education is such a broad topic. And when we're talking about affirmative action in the first segment and just working conditions for teachers in the second, it's hard to glue those together, but I think you've made a very good point of tying the first to the second, tying this anti-intellectualism, this push for, you know, ridding our schools of any mention of our history, of any mention of the diversity of our history, to, like, the teachers who don't want to be there anymore, the teachers who have left the profession, to the, like, ways in which our schools are falling apart. For this week, I'm Ryan.
I'm Lou.
I was Noah.
And this was Punching Out.
You've been listening to Punching Out. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Punching Out Wayo. Email us your work stories, complaints, and struggles to punchingoutwayo@gmail.com. Punching Out is a project of the Punching Out Collective. Our producer is Ryan Brister. Music for Punching Out is provided by Ariel Cruz. Tune in next week for more Punching Out, and remember, your boss isn't listening, but we are.